form.
BATF IRS CIANF BI FDA and FCC ADL and KGB. Now I know my ABCs, all of which spell tyranny.
But have we got tyranny, folks? Welcome. This is the Bloodlines Hour, actually 2 hours, with myself, Eli James, and Michael Swede from Sweden. And today we're going to be talking about the pre-existing conditions that led to the Weimar Republic, and that is the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles. And those were really two horrible pieces. Would you call it statesmanship, Michael, or treachery?
good day, everybody. Yeah, I would call it treachery because this was the first time when the Jews got so much influence in this so-called peace conference. It was not a peace conference. It was the Jews really tricked the Germans, so the Germans lost the war. That not a single bullet had fallen on Germany. So that was it was Jewish treachery.
That's right. Yeah. Now, Germany did not lose the war. Many people say that they lost the peace. Germany lost the peace. They did not lose the war. So welcome, everybody. This is Eurofolk Radio, simulcasting at Speak Free Radio. And by the way, I'm going to be leaving for Macanda, Illinois, right after the show today. I got my tent ready to set up as soon as I get there. And I got my goggles, my solar eclipse goggles. The weather is supposed to be partly cloudy, so it shouldn't be, like, today is pretty overcast, but it should clear up tomorrow at Macanda, Illinois. Hopefully I'll be able to get some video. I don't know if my cell phone camera can catch direct rays from the sun without frying the lens. I don't know. I'll have to check that out to see if I should do that. But people have been asking me to, send them a movie or at least some still shots. Well, I'll see what I can do. But certainly with my eclipse glasses, I'll be able to see the whole thing, and it's going to be spectacular. So in any case, by the way, the shows that Professor Truth and I have done on the subject, really good, prophetic significance of the X marks the spot eclipses. And I failed to post the part one. I don't know what happened, but part two is up right now. I'll see if I can get part one up, later this week. So I'll be in Macanda, Illinois, Monday, and it's the eclipse there is supposed to happen around 2 p.m. So if I can, I can even do a broadcast from there, because I'll have my hotspot, which has been acting up lately, and my computer, my laptop, and maybe I could actually do a live show. We'll see. Anyway, so let's get to it, Michael. I'm going to open up with the Paris Peace Conference. I put the link in. That is a government website here. U.S. Department of State Archive. And it's actually a pretty good article. I mean, it gives a fairly good overview. You know what? It occurred to me that, I'm looking at the picture of these four gentlemen, if we can call them that, the four stooges. In 1919, the Big Four met in Paris to negotiate the treaty. Lloyd George of Britain, Vittorio Emanuel Orlando of Italy, George Clemenceau of France, and Woodrow Wilson of the U.S. They failed to picture the Jewish aides, the Jewish advisors that each one of them had at the Paris Peace Conference. So, and of course, Woodrow Wilson had Colonel House, a dedicated Jewish communist, as his advisor. And things didn't go Woodrow Wilson's way. He was pretty much overruled by the Jewish contingent. at these two conferences. So let's get to it. It says, the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles. The Paris Peace Conference was an international meeting convened in January 1919 at Versailles, just outside Paris. The purpose of the meeting was to establish the terms of the peace after World War I. Though nearly 30 nations participated, the representatives of Great Britain, France, the United States, and Italy became known as the Big Four. The Big Four would dominate the proceedings. No, the Jews would dominate the proceedings that led to the formulation of the Treaty of Versailles, a treaty that articulated the compromise reached at the conference. The Treaty of Versailles included a plan to form a League of Nations that would serve as an international forum and an international collective security arrangement, so-called, is actually a Jewish overlordship. U.S. President Woodrow Wilson was a strong advocate of the League as he believed it would prevent future wars. Well, he was finagled into that war by the Jews, and he really had no choice. He campaigned for re-election on the promise that I did not send our boys to Europe for the war. And then as soon as he got re-elected, he changed his position and got us into the war. Negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference were not always easy. Great Britain, France, and Italy fought together during the First World War as Allied powers. The United States entered the war in April 1917 as an associated power. And while it fought on the side of the Allies, it was not bound to honor pre-existing agreements between the Allied powers. Actually, it was America was neutral during World War I until Woodrow Wilson got us involved. These agreements tended to focus on post-war redistribution of territories. U.S. President Woodrow Wilson strongly opposed many of these arrangements, including Italian demands on the Adriatic. This often led to significant disagreements among the Big Four. This was the Balkanization of Europe and the Middle East. That's what the Paris Peace Conference actually did. In each case, the lines were drawn by the Zionists and the and Britain, maybe to some extent France, but the United States was not involved in redrawing the lines of these various nations. Treaty negotiations were also weakened by the absence of other important nations. Russia had fought as one of the Allies until December 1917. When its new Bolshevik government withdrew from the war, Michael, isn't this what happened to the Germans after World War I? The Bolsheviks tried to take over Germany?
Yes, that was one of their try to do that, but fortunately the Germans, Freikorps, were able to save Germany from that certain destruction.
Yes, because I guess they didn't plan the German defeat by communism well enough. They certainly had the means. It was Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Niebleck. Hi. I'm a German. I should be able to pronounce that. Niebleck. Anyway, so these two Jewish communists tried to organize a revolution in Germany. Nobody ever talks about that, folks. The history books totally ignore that. And the academics are clueless. So let's continue. The Allied powers refused the new Bolshevik government and thus did not invite its representatives to the peace conference. The Allies were angered by the Bolshevik decision to repudiate Russia's outstanding financial debts to the Allies and to publish a text of secret agreements between the Allies concerning the post-war period. Man, I'd like to see those. Secret agreements between the Allies concerning the post-war period. Wow. Well, that would include the Zionists. The Allies also excluded the defeated Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, and Bulgaria. According to the French and British wishes, Germany was subjected to strict punitive measures under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Very strict. Very strict. Way too strict. The new German, because Germany was not the instigator of the war. the new German government was required to surrender approximately 10% of its pre-war territory in Europe and all of its overseas possessions. The harbor city of Danzig, now Gdansk, and the coal-rich Saarland were placed under the administration of the League of Nations. And France, now here is a strictly Jewish organization, the League of Nations. And now we have the United Nations, which is also a strictly Jewish organization, all financed by Rothschild and other Jewish bankers. And France was allowed to exploit the economic resources of the Saarland until 1935. The German army and navy were limited in size. Kaiser Wilhelm II and a number of other high-ranking German officials were to be tried as war criminals under the terms of Article 231 of the treaty. The Germans accepted responsibility for the war and as such were liable to pay for financial reparations to the Allies. Now, this sentence leaves out, I think the Kaiser had abdicated before this, and the people who accepted responsibility for the war were socialists and communists, mainly of Jewish extraction, who they're the ones who formed the, what do you call, the Weimar Republic. Okay? This was created after Kaiser Wilhelm abdicated, and because he was afraid the communist revolution was going to overthrow Germany and he'd be their number one target, just like the Tsar of Russia was. Okay. So let me repeat this here. The Germans, quote, that should have a huge asterisk. It wasn't the Germans. It was the fake Weimar government that took over after World War I, after the Paris Peace Conference and the Versailles Treaty. Accepted responsibility for the war and as such were liable to pay financial reparations to the Allies. Though the actual amount would be determined by an inter-allied commission that would present its findings in 1921, the amount they determined was 132 billion gold Reichmarks, or $32 billion. Now, I don't think Germany had $132 billion in gold, all right, which came on top of an initial $5 billion payment demanded by the treaty. Germans would grow to resent these harsh conditions imposed by the Treaty of Versailles, especially since Germany did not start the war and did not lose the war either. While the Treaty of Versailles did not present a peace agreement that satisfied all parties concerned, by the time President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States in July 1919, American public opinion was overwhelmingly in favor of ratifying the treaty, including the covenant of the League of Nations. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that 32 state legislatures passed resolutions in favor of the treaty, there was intense opposition to it within the U.S. Senate. Cooler heads prevailed. And this is one of the reasons why, Michael, the Democrats wanted to get rid of the, what's it called? The system of the Electoral College, because the U.S. Senate was independent. And so from the Congress, and it wasn't elected by the people, it was elected by the states. So in other words, the U.S. Senate truly represented the states, and the states did not want it, and the U.S. Senate did not want this treaty, and that's a good thing, because the Jews would have had total control of planet Earth at the end of World War I. Senate opposition to the Treaty of Versailles cited Article 10 of the treaty, which dealt with collective security and the League of Nations. This article, opponents argued, ceded the war powers of the U.S. government to the League's Council, and America has done the same with the United Nations. We have allowed U.N. troops to flood into our country and troops of other nations into our country as if we were not even a country anymore. The opposition came from two groups of the irreconcilables, who refused to join the League of Nations under any circumstances, and reservationists led by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Henry Cabot Lodge, who were willing to ratify the treaty with amendments. While Lodge was defeated in his attempt to pass amendments to the treaty in September, he did manage to attach 14 reservations to it in November. In a final vote of March 19, 1920, the Treaty of Versailles fell short of ratification by 7 votes. Consequently, the U.S. government signed the Treaty of Berlin on August 25, 1921. This was a separate peace treaty with Germany that stipulated that the United States would enjoy all rights, privileges, indemnities, reparations, or advantages conferred to it by the Versailles Treaty, but left out any mention of the League of Nations, which the United States never joins. And that's a good thing. The conservatives, in America prevailed at this time. So this is, a nice summary of, what went on, but it leaves out enormous details of subversion and treachery that go into these two events. Okay. So now we're going to switch to an article entitled The Treaty. Hold on. I've got to the Treaty of Versailles, and the full title of which I have to scroll up. The Treaty of Versailles, a gathering of hope that gave way to hell on earth. And that is a really good title. Let's see how much hell Colin Schindler reveals. All right, over to you, Michael.
Thank you. So, Versailles was Zionism's first international platform, thanks to British Jewish leaders. But the treaty was a factor in the rise of Nazism. Using that word for National Socialist is not so good, because that is a Jewish term to call it that way. Uh-huh. So, 100 years ago, on 28th of June, 1919, the victorious power in the First World War signed the Treaty of Versailles with Germany. It was followed by treachery with Austria, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Turkey, and defeated powers in a conflict in which millions lost their lives. The Paris Peace Conference in 1919 was supposed to translate the hopes of all those who fought a war to end all wars into a golden future. The leaders of the victorious
David... The Jews getting all the gold.
Exactly.
With the Jews... There you go.
Yeah, okay. And that was the idea, that if they would have gotten all the gold, then maybe they would World War II wouldn't have started. But Hitler, he changed that. He kicked them out. So he didn't have the gold in Germany. Right. So That's right.
Whatever wealth Germany had was taken. Was taken by the Versailles, the leaders of the Versailles Peace Conference.
Yeah. The leaders of the victors, David Lloyd George, Britain, George Clemenceau, France.
Clemenceau.
Woodrow Wilson, United States, and Vittorio Emanuele Orlando, Italy, had put aside domestic politics, traveled to Paris to proceed to redraw the map of the world in their own image and national interest.
That's correct. Well, actually, Zionist interest. I don't see. I wonder how deeply this article gets into the Jewish presence. It's interesting that he mentions them. That's very good. Okay.
President Wilson proclaimed the right to national self-determination of all nations, but this does not apply to those outside Europe. That's history.
Okay. How about America? The plight of America? Do we have the right to self-determination, folks?
That should every nation have, but in Sweden, absolutely not. There we have been usurped for so long time, and you have also been so usurped now for the last 100 years with the Jewish oligarchs that is ruling our nation.
Amen.
As history records, the treaty flaws were a factor in the rise of Nazism, and Hitler used German grievance to mask his plan to dominate Europe and to instigate the murder of 6 million Jews. no, not really. That's bullshit.
Scratch that paragraph. Right. Scratch that paragraph. Yeah, that all his bullshit. Grievances were accurate. True. Back to you. Yeah.
Thank you. So, Germany's citizens felt humiliated, despondent, and angry at the sudden turn of events during the autumn of 1918. Even before their delegation left to sign the agreement, there were leaflet circulating in Berlin stating that it was composed of Jews who sold Germany to the Allies. And that's true.
Amen. That's absolutely true. Yep.
On the same day as the signing of the Versailles Treaty, a Polish minority right agreement was also signed, which was designed to offer protection to the ethnic minorities in Eastern Europe in the bitter conflagration between Poles, Ukrainians, and others after hostilities had ceased between Germany and the Allies. Just days after the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month, Polish troops committed a pogrom in Lemberg, Levy. This was followed by atrocities in Pinsk and Vilna. The Poles initially strongly resisted committing to a minority right agreement and had ever refused to respond to a draft of the document.
Okay.
They were asserting their national rights, yep.
The Paris Peace Conference was the first occasion when the Jews as a national group had a voice in the international arena. The International Committee des Délégations Juives had come to France to argue for the rights of persecuted Jewry. It possessed faith in the newly formed League of Nations and the justice for the Jews world would prevail. Yeah, but that's not really true.
No, it's not true. It's propaganda. The Jews were never persecuted. There was always a reaction to their evil works, especially their money-lending operations throughout the entirety of the 1900 years since they executed Christ. And Christians around the world hated Jews for the things they were doing within their countries. Okay, so it's hard to say that the Jews were a national group. They were pretty much disorganized, and the rabbis who operated within particular countries were more like imams. They were more like imams, and how should I put it? Local spiritual or religious leaders that really did not have a powerful organization over them, except, of course, the Jewish bankers. So if the Jewish bankers had an agenda, these rabbis would fall in line. But you cannot say they had a national consciousness. I wouldn't say so. All right. Back
but
to you.
Didn't that also start with the conference the Jews had in Basel, where they met all the rabbis, met and when they started to vilify Adolf Hitler's regime?
Right. Well, that was in 1897, the Basel, Switzerland. That was the first Zionist conference. And yeah, that's when you could say the Jews began organizing as an international group. They still don't even have a country of their own, which they could say, well, this is the home exclusively of Jews. And even in Palestine, it's not a home of exclusively Jews. They have an ethnic minority called Palestinians who they've been persecuting for 75 years, annihilating, genociding, ethnically cleansing for 75 years. It's amazing there are any of them left. But anyway, that's a stolen national home, absolutely stolen. So the Jews still don't have a place of their own because they're the descendants of Cain, who was deemed to be a wanderer and a vagabond for his entire existence, and that's still true today. You know, let me ask you a question. What's the likelihood of all Jews in the world moving to Israel right now?
It's very slim, I would say. I don't think it would happen. That's a farce all in itself, that the Jews would move down to that stinking place down in the Middle East.
Yeah. Now, isn't it interesting that Americans have a national home? You know, so Americans come from America and they go to other countries that they're known as Americans. And Swedes, same thing. Sweden is their national home, and they may travel abroad, but people will know them as Swedes, Frenchmen, Germans, etc. but not Jews. Jews, the vast majority of Jews in the world, never set foot in Palestine, even today. So how can they be considered? How can that be considered the national home of the Jews when, what, I would roughly guessing maybe 10% of the world Jews have ever even been to Palestine? Something wrong with this picture, folks. All right, back to you, Michael.
Thank you. And I said wrong. The Basel, they didn't vilify Hitler then. As I said, it was that was the first Zionist conference when they started to act as a group, more cohesion group.
Yes. Yeah. So, they're still, the Jews are still mainly an international group, not a national group.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Or their kind of nationality, maybe, that they view as their nationality, right. And that is Zionism.
Right, that's Zionism, right, exactly.
The Zionists had managed to secure a slot to put their case before the Council of Ten at the peace conference. Other struggles to gain admittance to the proceedings. The Emir Faisal, the foremost leader of the Arab world at the time, and a prominent of a unitary state of all Arabs, was initially buried by the France. While little behind him, Chaim Weizmann was the consummate diplomat, rushing from one meeting to another, cultivating the high and mighty. He was adept and charming the English upper class, whose members were often disparaging towards Jews. As the Foreign Office Robert Cecil put it, one forget Weizmann's rather repellent and even sordid exterior. Weizmann's presence in Paris was crucial, as Clément had recently promised not to contest British rule over Palestine. His focus was on protecting France from future invasion from Germany, and expected Britain in turn to support the establishment of a buffer state in the Rhineland. No one endorsed Clemenceau's proposal. 2 decades later, France was defeated with weeks in 1940 despite the Maginot Line. On 27th of February 1919, the Zionist Nahum Sokolov, Menachem Uzikin, and Chaim Weizmann addressed the Council of Ten. Sokolov spoke about the travails of Jewish history, while Weizmann suggested that 5 million Jews could be settled in Palestine without affecting the indigenous Arab population. What a lie.
Not six? Only 5 million?
I thought that too.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
1 million persecuted Jews in Eastern Europe, Weizmann claimed would leave at a moment's notice. However, it was the veteran Ushenkin who impressed, because he addressed to the council in a seemingly dead language, Hebrew, the tongue of kings and prophets, which we have never forgotten. Yeah, it wasn't
actually
Hebrew.
They never learned it. Yeah, they never learned it.
It was Yiddish.
More pretense. That's right. There you go.
Uzi Hikin majestically projected the biblical imagery of a people who had survived against all the odds down the long centuries of dispersion. He told them, "I, a son of these exiles, come to you in the name of my bereft people, to you who serve both politically and culturally as the heirs of the Romans, and make my demands to you." Restify the injustice of that historic robbery. Restore our land to us. The allusion the allusion to Old Testament grandeur and implicitly a common Judeo-Christian heritage was put
into it. There wasn't any such thing. There wasn't any such thing in those days. The Jews and Christians still hated each other. Okay.
Yeah, that was Scofield's reference Bible.
Was just getting going. Exactly, right.
Yet, the first Zionist map of 1918 did not reproduce any border in the Hebrew Bible. It instead concentrated on practical concerns such as access to water, the Litani River in Lebanon, and transportation, the Hayas Railway in Jordan. Although Weizmann found supporters in Lloyd George and Balfour, the French were decidedly hostile. There was a strong domestic opposition to Clement's decisions to hand over Palestine to the British. The Croix d'Orsay was not amused. They continued to adhere to the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement of May 1916, in which the Middle Eastern areas of the moribund Ottoman Empire would be divided up between the British and the French at the war's end. Promise to both Zionist Jew and Hashemite Arabs were of temporary importance to win the war.
Now that's correct. They were never issued sincerely. Okay.
Despite
we want to take what we want to take and don't get in the way. Okay.
Yeah. Despite being a fluent French speaker, Weizmann told friends that in the company of the French at the conference, we speak a different language. The French had originally barred Ziskins from participating, but he was able to replace a delayed Zionist leader. The French insisted on the inclusion of the non-Zionist Sylvain Levy, who proceeded to downgrade Zionist aspirations during the course of his address. He projected himself as a Jewish Frenchman rather than as French Jew, and asked why should the Jews speak specially privilege for themselves in Palestine. He argued that Palestine could not possibly absorb millions and France, as the historic protector of Christians in the Levant, should be offered the mandate for Palestine.
Okay, instead of the British. Very interesting. Okay.
The Zionists were stunned at this unexpected turn of events, and only when the American... and only when the American Secretary of State Robert Lansing turned to Weizmann's was Levy exposition rebutted. A furious Weizmann later confronted Levy and called him a traitor. In the midst of the rivalry between the British for the spoils of war in the Middle East, there was little love lost between the French and the Zionists. One observer reported that Clemenceau told Weizmann that Christians cannot forgive the Jews for crucifying Christ.
Clemenceau! Good going!
Yeah. That the leaders know before. Now they don't know that, so now we are where we are.
Yeah, well, I think also, I mean, all the French heads of state had to know that it was the Jews, the Rothschilds, and other Jewish bankers that caused the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror. I'm sure Clemenceau had that in mind, too.
Yeah. To which Weizmann reported, "Your France would refuse Christ a visa because he was a political agitator."
Well, he wasn't a Frenchman, was he?
No, right? He would probably call them a German.
Do you think the Jews of Palestine would offer Yahshua a visa?
No. No. They are the one. They would be behind the French government to say he would not have a visa. That's why, because the Jews
there
would
go.
Be... not the French people.
All right.
It's the
you
Jewish
know
minority.
Too much, Michael. You know too much. All right.
Weizmann famously met Emir Faisal in 1919 and signed an amicable agreement pledging cooperation. History intervened. Faisal was ejected from Syria by the French and later installed by the British as King of Iraq. His dream of ruling a single state for the Arabs disintegrated before great power machinations. His father was driven out of Arabia and his grandson murdered in the Iraqi coup of 1958. Today, Jordan remains the only bastion of Hashemite rule. Weizmann's long service to the Zionist cause was recognized when he became Israel's first president in 1949. The Zionist presence at the Paris Peace Conference was more symbolic than achieving a political breakthrough, but did come to the scene as a watershed in Jewish history. A JC editorial in January 1919 commented, "We hope that the peace that will be made at Paris will be a peace of justice for the Jews of the world."
There's no such thing as justice with Jews. No such
no.
thing. Okay. Okay, I see this is a much shorter, a much shorter article than I thought. The next article is about Joan Rivers. She wasn't at the Paris Peace Conference. So I selected Benjamin Friedman because his article is the absolute best on the subject. And so we'll conclude with this and then go to Benjamin Friedman. Back to you.
Sounds good. So it was not to be. Versailles were mercifully an interlude in the savagery and lost from 1914 to 1945. The Allies may have won this war, but the Jews certainly lost it. No, not really.
No, it's the other way around. The Allies lost the war, the Jews won it. Okay? Because they're the ones who dictated the boundaries of the various countries afterwards. Okay? With their interference in the proceedings. There were way too many Jews at the peace conference. Way too many Jews. And every single head of state, at least big four, and major countries, possibly, I wonder even if Germany, I bet even Germany had Jews representing it because those were Weimar politicians, right? So it's possible that virtually every, I think you said 50 nations, it's possible that every single one of those countries had Jewish representatives, and the rich Rothschilds would make sure that every country had a Jewish representative. They could afford it, okay? All right, so a much better article than most for mainstream commentary, but of course it's not talking about the Jews' operations in the background. So I'm going to go now to, I put this article in the chat room, and can you grab it from there, Michael? Now it has the audio of Benjamin Friedman giving this speech in 1961 at the Willard Hotel in Washington. And if you want to listen to that, you can do that after today's show. But it also has these comments and the transcript of what he said. So let's get to it. All right. Benjamin Friedman's speech, unedited version, 1961. Topics: New World Order, Federal Reserve, Jews, Zionism, Israel, and the language is in English. Has 11,000 views. Should have a lot more than that. Should have had a million views. Personal information. Friedman was born on October 4th, 1890 in New York City. Friedman claimed that he was present at the 1912 presidential campaign as an assistant to Bernard Baruch and regularly sat at meetings with candidate Woodrow Wilson. He claimed in a speech that he was a liaison between Rolla Wells and Henry Morgenthau Sr., another big Jew. This could only have been with the Democrat National Committee sometime between 1912 and 1916, as in that year, Rollo Wells was appointed to, appointed a governor of the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis. Now, I've never heard of this character, Rollo Wells. Sounds like he might be white, but no guarantee on that.
Can he have something to do with Wells Fargo?
No, Wells Fargo existed well before that in the cowboy days of America. Right. Mm-hmm. His World War One draft registration card states that he was living at 340 West 86th Street in New York. A few houses away at 309 lived Samuel D. Leidesdorf. The 1925 New York City director lists Benjamin H. Friedman-Salisbury Co., also living at the same address. It is Mrs. Moritz Friedman, his widowed mother. His partner in this company is listed as Milton S. Salisbury. New York Times, May 10th, 1924, page 21, dissolution notice. The co-partnership of Friedman Salisbury Co., composed of Benjamin H. Friedman and Milton S. Salisbury, and also doing business as the Hercules Saw Sales Company of America, with address at 233 Broadway, New York City, has been dissolved. Milton S. Salisbury was the son of Buffalo Bills manager Nate Salisbury. Oh, sounds like a Jew to me. Okay. He was at one time a partner with Samuel D. Leidesdorf in John H. Woodbury and the John H. Woodbury Laboratories, a dermatological institute, and a derivative company of the old Woodbury Soap Company. He states that he was in that business from, I would say, 1925 to 1937 or 1938. So he was involved in the Woodbury Soap Company. I don't know if they still exist. Can't remember the last time I remember buying Woodbury soap when I was a kid. Anyway, Benjamin H. Friedman is listed in the city directory as living at the Paramount Hotel. Benjamin H. Friedman was listed on the letterhead of the Institute for Arab American Affairs. And around 1946, along with his wife, listed as R.M. Schoendorf, sponsored a series of advertisements under the imprint of the League for Peace and Justice in Palestine. So apparently he had sided with the Arabs already here at this point in time. In 1946, he sued the American Jewish Committee for $5 million for libel. In 1948, he, through Hallam Richardson, attorney for the League for Peace with Justice in Palestine, sued the non-sectarian anti-Nazi League founded by Samuel Untermeyer, our friend Untermeyer again, for criminal libel. That they had libeled Mr. Richardson in a pamphlet by saying he had long been known in the halls of a pro-fascist propaganda. The case was heard before Hyman Bushell in Manhattan court for 23 days and then dismissed. That's interesting because Hyman Bushell sounds like a Jewish name. So even the Jewish judge dismissed the case. In 1954, his address is stated to be 960 Park Avenue. He contributed money to Condon McGinley, publisher of the periodical Common Sense. Okay. In 1955, Rabbi Joachim Prince, spelled with a Z, later president of the American Jewish Congress, sued McGinley for branding him as a red rabbi. Okay. Yeah, your comment, Michael?
Nah, but it's interesting to see, to read those, because I wasn't aware of all this, information here about Friedman, that he had sided with the Arabs already. And Joachim Prince, he's probably true that he was a red rabbi, that's for sure.
Yeah. There are many red rabbis. I'd say 90% of the rabbis in the world are actually communists, hiding their communist affiliations, etc. Okay. And Friedman was called as a witness. He also produced several pamphlets over the years. The New York Times reported a meeting at the Henry George School where Benjamin H. Friedman spoke on the genesis of Middle East tensions. And again, they reported that Long John Nebel, N-E-B-E-L, on WNBC will discuss anti-Semitism with Benjamin H. Friedman, industrialist. He continued his political activities until the mid-1970s, when he was well over 85 years old. Benjamin Friedman died in May 1984, at the age of 94. His wife was named Rose Friedman as a revisionist. Okay, so, all right, well, we only have about 10 minutes left before we take a break, but go ahead and pick it up here. The casus belli, or casus belli, for the American entry into World War One. This should be good. We're talking about treachery, folks. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you. So, in The Hidden Tyranny, Friedman explained the American entry into the war thus: Congress only declared war against Germany because President Wilson informed Congress that the German submarine had sunk the SS Sussex in the English Channel and in violation of international law, and that United States citizen aboard the SS Sussex had perished with the ship. This claim can be compared with the text of Wilson's message to Congress on April 2, 1917. Here, the alleged plot against Germany. He claimed a conspiracy among powerful Zionists in the banking and financial elite to undermine Germany during World War One. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, now we're getting somewhere. This is accurate reporting here. All right.
He also claimed that a group of Zionists offered to embroil the United States into World War One on the Allied side in return to British support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. He claimed the support was offered in the form of the Balfour Declaration issued by the British government to the head of the British Jewish community, Lord Rothschilds. He claimed that he was there and ought to know. Claims of Jewish control of newspaper. Yeah, that's true also. Not claims, they're true fact.
Yep. Now, he was one Jew that actually spoke the truth about just about everything. Some people have speculated that he wasn't, in fact, born a Jew, but that he was a white man adopted by Jewish parents. I tend to agree with that, but I haven't checked it out. Back to you.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, Friedman, and then you have this other one. Bobby Fischer also was also very condemnation of his own tribe.
Oh, all right, yeah.
But I think didn't they kill him also, Bobby Fischer? Or did he manage to survive?
Sure. He moved to Japan, but I don't think he's alive anymore.
No. Yeah, maybe he survived. I know they tried to kill him because what he said.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah.
Friedman also claimed that the newspaper at the time were owned by Jews. He also claimed that their newspaper were pro-German before the war, and that after the alleged deal was struck between the Zionists and the British, that these newspapers became anti-German, blackmailing Woodrow Wilson. Yeah, blackmailing Woodrow Wilson.
You know. Yep. Now we get the juicy details.
Yeah, but right. This Untermeyer did.
Yeah.
Friedman also claimed that the prominent lawyer Samuel Untermeyer visited President Wilson in the White House and threatened him with a breach of promise suit on behalf of the wife of a Princeton professor with whom Friedman alleged Wilson had carried on an affair, to whom he offered marriage. Untermeyer's client wanted $40,000, which Wilson did not have. Untermeyer offered to pay his client off if Wilson would allow Untermeyer to dictate the next available Supreme Court nomination, which in the event went to Louis Brandeis. For an account of the law involved here, see breach of promise. for a detailed and documented account of Wilson's close relation with Brandeis and his desire to have him as his first attorney general. See the first two volumes of Arthur S. Link Wilson's. Yeah, I guess that was how the Jews got their hands upon your Supreme Court, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, Louis Brandeis. I checked him out. He was an American-born Jew, but the very first Jewish Supreme Court justice.
Friedman's connections and claimed connections with public figures. Besides Baruch and Wilson, Friedman claimed to be acquainted with Henry Morgenthau, Sir Samuel Untermeyer, Franklin Roosevelt, Joseph Kennedy, and his son John F. Kennedy, and other influential persons such as H.L. Hunt and son Nelson Bunker. He also claimed to have attended the Versailles Peace Conference. Friedman was an advisor to Nelson Bunker Hunt, an American businessman most famous for his silver dealings. As he was a friend of his father, H.L. Hunt, who was believed to be the richest man in the world at the time of his death. In Robert John Young's Behind the Balfour Declaration, published by the Institute for Historical Review, the only acknowledgement is to Friedman. John says that Friedman gave me copies of materials on the Balfour Declaration, which I might never have found on my own, and encouraged my own research. Called Curtis B. Dahl, put Friedman in a list of unspecified acknowledgement in FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, a book about father-in-law and 32nd President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Roosevelt. Yeah, the Delanos were a Jewish family, so apparently on his mother's side, he's Jewish, which makes him a full-blooded Jew.
Yeah. So, publications, Common Sense. Benjamin Friedman contributed funds toward the once well-known newspaper, Common Sense, published by Conde McGinley. In an article in the February 1955 issue of Commentary Magazine, he is cited as a financial backer of Conde McGinley, published of the periodical Common Sense. In the libel trial by Rabbi Joachim Prince against McGinley, Friedman as a witness testified that he had given Mr. McGinley financial support of more than $10,000, but less than $100,000. League for Peace with Justice in Palestine.
Okay. There's something missing here. There's like a black line that should have text, but it doesn't.
I can find it, I think. Okay. I can click on it. So,
yeah.
After the demise of Common Sense, Benjamin Friedman continued to write and publish his own broadsheet under the aegis of the League of Peace with Justice in Palestine, which he had founded in 1946.
Okay. So he was doing his best to help the Palestinian people, which is very, very odd for a Jew. If he really was a Jew, a blood Jew, okay? Because Jews don't have any sympathy for Palestinians or anybody else for that matter. You know, their religion, the Talmud, is nothing but supremacism and hatred for other people. So, okay, well, we're just about ready to take a break. And we'll conclude this section here on a description of the book Facts Are Facts, written by Benjamin Friedman. And then we're going to go to Facts Are Facts by Benjamin Friedman. And we'll conclude today's show with that. But that's a longer presentation. we might follow through with this next week also. Okay, so folks, I'm going to, let's see, pick up some music here. And this is a song called Epic Forest.
Hello, we all should know.
Okay, we'll be back in about 5 or 6 minutes, folks. Okay, folks, that is a song by a rare bird called Epic Forest, a British band that did a lot of avant-garde style music, rarely played on the radio ever. So, but very interesting lyrics and song by Rare Bird. Actually, they had a lot of albums, like 8 or 9 albums, but never, they were always under the radar. Hardly ever played. on the radio. So let me just quickly go to Money Tree Publishing, and I'm going to click on a couple of these books to see what the blurbs are about. MoneyTreePublishing.com. And the book, The Myth of German Villainy, is, you have to click on it. If you go to MoneyTreePublishing.com, click on it. And it says, there's by Ben Bradbury, U.S. Navy retired, he says, quote, "After traveling around most of Europe, Germany emerged as my favorite country. During our visits there, we found the German people to be pleasant, industrious, disciplined, and civilized, with many similarities to traditional Americans. They in no way resemble the stereotypes depicted in all of the anti-Nazi movies, books, and articles we have been subjected to over the years. During both world wars, fantastic atrocity stories were invented to provoke hatred of Germany and the German people in order to convince the public to support the wars. Quote unquote, Holocaust propaganda, which emerged after World War II, further solidified this image of Germany as history's ultimate villain. But how true is this official story? Do the facts bear the claims out? Read on to find out how you've been lied to." Boy, have we been lied to. And what else is new? Okay. So, looks like a really good book. Let's see what they have to say about The International Jew by Henry Ford. Okay. Famous American industrialist and automobile manufacturer Henry Ford's full, unexpurgated original of his groundbreaking study of the Jewish question, originally published by the Dearborn Independent between 1920 and 22, as a four-volume set in a completely reset edition, combines all four volumes into a handy two-volume version without losing any of the text. This is the only complete set of all 80 unexpurgated articles, which were earlier republished in book form, but severely redacted and edited, with an abridged version becoming the most widely circulated copy. Volumes 1 and 2 contain articles 1 through 42, and volumes 3 and 4 contain articles 43 to 80, with topics including foreign and domestic issues, and contain by far the best analysis of how the United States was systematically taken over by Jews after they were allowed to immigrate to our country in large numbers. Absolutely no doubt about that. The Dearborn Independent was distributed nationwide to Ford dealer showrooms and was offered free of charge to the general public. At its peak, weekly circulation reached 700,000, and the work's reach was worldwide and was quoted in Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Very good. Henry Ford's picture hung in Hitler's office, and in July 1938, the German consul at Cleveland gave Ford, on his 75th birthday, the award of the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, the highest medal Nazi Germany could bestow on a foreigner. So, I do have a copy of The International Jew. I've only read parts of it. It's a long read, folks. Some of the other books available are The War Against Whites, Jews Are the Problem, The Great Impersonation by yours truly, Exposing the Lies of History, and Communism by the Back Door, Hellstorm, The Secret Masonic Victory of World War II, and, of course, the Masons working hand in glove with the Jews worldwide. Going back to the French Revolution and earlier, is untold history that you will never find in your libraries or in academia. You will not find those anywhere besides the press of the conspiratologists. Okay, and that's what we are. We're conspiratologists. All right, so let's get back to this article about Benjamin Friedman, and then we'll actually delve into his transcript, actually his book, Facts Are Facts. Back to you, Michael.
Thank you. So, Facts Are Facts. This is a pamphlet purporting to be the text of a 1954 letter from Friedman to David Goldstein, a Jewish convert to Catholicism. and an exponent of the idea that Christianity fulfilled Judaism. The text.
Oh, wow. Go ahead. That is a false idea, of course.
Yeah, that is a false idea. The text expounds the notion that most people now identified as Jews are the descendants of Khazars, a Turkic people of Central Asia who converted to Judaism. Throughout the text of this pamphlet, the author never refers to Jews simplicity. He always referred to so-called or self-styled Jews. It must be noted that Judaism only began in 500 AD with the completion of the Babylonian Talmud. It can also be found a criticism of the Kol Nidre, a Jewish tradition, all vows, oaths, promises, engagement, and swearing, which beginning this very day of reconciliation, we intend to vow, promise, swear, and bind ourselves to fulfill. We repent of beforehand. Let them be illegalized, acquitted, annihilated, abolished, valueless, unimportant. Our vows shall be no vows, and our oath, no oath at all. Friedman considered it as a complete assumed disloyalty.
All right, impersonation. Okay, so it has a link there to metapedia.org, wiki, Benjamin Friedman. And there's reviews here, so we won't bother with those. So let's get into Facts Are Facts by Benjamin Friedman. Let's see. This is 1954, and this is RevelationOutpost.com. RevelationOutpost.com, and I'll pick it up here. 1954. The truth about the Khazars, the so-called Jews, distinguishing between the Jew and Hebrews who are Israelites. Okay? The historic facts revealed here for the first time provide incontestable evidence that their continued suppression will prove inimical to the security of the nation, the peace of the world, the welfare of humanity, and the progress of civilization. I can vouch for that. Although depending on what the facts are, because last night, on Restoration Hour, I was reading from an outstanding book about the history of the 12 tribes, published in 1897 by Joseph Will, who is a Christian identity book, exposing the difference between Jews and Israelites. So, and not giving the Jews credit for being Israelites. So that's really great. A very much suppressed book, which I had never heard of up until this week. So I'm going to be continuing doing the shows about that. And I'll put the link for that book in the chat room as well for those who want to read it. It's really fantastic. So let's continue. Original note, a facsimile reproduction reprinted and typeset to meet the many requests for a copy of the letter addressed to Dr. David Goldstein of Boston, Massachusetts, by its author, Benjamin H. Friedman of New York City, dated October 10th, 1954. Okay, and annotation provided by RevelationOutpost.com editor. So here we have an insert about Benjamin Friedman. Benjamin Friedman wrote for the newspaper Common Sense after World War II. In his earlier life, he was a Zionist operative, but later he converted to Catholicism. This unique book was a lengthy letter written to his friend, Dr. David Goldstein, LLD. It is also unique in the fact that it is straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. In great detail, Friedman reveals why today's self-styled Jews should not be confused with Judeans or Judahites, that Jesus was not a Jew, that Jews are not Semites, and that the corrupted word Jew only came about in the 18th century and never should have been used as a substitute for Judean in the Bible. And that's essentially correct, because the word Jew, as translated from Judah in the Old Testament, should have been left Judah, or Judahites, should never have been translated as Jew. But he's saying here, it only came about in the 18th century. And of course, this is with the publication of the King James Version, which was subject to the Masoretic text, which is a Jewish perversion of the original Hebrew. So that is accurate. The Jews are not Semites, okay? Jesus was not a Jew. The Jews are not Semites. And that the corrupted word Jew only came about in the 18th century and never should have been used as a substitute for Judean in the Bible. He proves that Christians have been horribly duped by this wordplay, and he holds the clergy and powerful Jewish interests culpable for trumpeting the lie that Jesus was a Jew, which suggested he was of the same bloodline as today's Jews. Bloodline, that's a good word. I like that. He was not. This then leads to the erroneous belief that Jews are a special people above reproach, i.e. chosen by God. This is a monumental lie. Modern Jews are a mixture of races whose common ancestry traces back to the Canaanite Edomites that occupied Judea, Samaria, and Galilee in Jesus' day. This makes them Hamites? Wait a minute. Let me just read this over. Modern Jews are a mixture of races whose common ancestry traces back to the Canaanite Edomites that occupied Judea, Samaria, and Galilee in Jesus' day. This makes them Hamites. Well, in a sense, they're not really Hamites either, because the Canaanites, the various branches of the Hamitic people, but yeah, Canaan was a Hamite. But he married into the tribes of the Kenites. The Kenites pre-existed Canaan, and so they're really not Hamites. It's a similar situation with Esau, folks, okay? So you have Canaan, who was in fact a Hamite, but his descendants are not Hamites. His descendants are Canaanites, as distinguished from Hamites, because he married into the fallen angel race of Cain. And the same thing occurred with Esau. He married into the fallen angel race of Canaanites. Okay. So the Canaanite / Edomite people have very, very little Shemitic, Hamitic blood. Almost none, because it's still the bloodline of Cain. Okay. So that's really how it works. Although, yeah. But these people are not, identity. But nevertheless, what they're saying here is much better than you'll get from other sources. Okay. So, this makes them Hamites, not Shemites, since Canaan, forefather of the Canaanites, was Ham's son. In the following centuries, many of these erstwhile Judeans migrated to the nation of Khazaria, which existed from the 8th to the 13th centuries. Through the military actions of the U.S. Zionist Jewish-controlled government, a replica of Khazaria is being constructed with Greater Israel Project, a.k.a. Eretz Israel. 90% or more of today's Jews are Edomite, Canaanite, Khazarian Ashkenazis, whose ancestors migrated from Eastern Europe, eventually claiming to be Jews because they practice a religion known as Judaism, and claimed that their ancient ancestors were from the tribe of Judah. No, they were from Judea. Judaism. Judaism, Friedman proves, is the same religion as the tradition of the elders, a.k.a. Pharisaism, which was reviled and condemned by Jesus. Pure-blooded white people, those legitimately descended from the tribe of Judah, that is Judahites, and the other 11 tribes of Israel are the true Shemites. The word Semite means descended from Noah's son Shem. Thus, the often hurled invective anti-Semite is a mind-numbing psycho-ploy concocted by devious Jews, biblical Esau, to deflect legitimate criticism of their destructive agendas. and in particular their opening, or ongoing rather, genocide of whites, biblical Jacob, truth is stranger than fiction, editor, Revelation Outpost. I'll quickly read this section on Benjamin Friedman here. Benjamin Friedman was a quote-unquote Jew who converted to Catholicism. In his unique essay, he reveals astounding truths about the Jews, their racial lineage, their religion, and the Antichrist agenda of big money Jewish interests. Perhaps most importantly, he proves that Jesus was not a Jew, which is contrary to what most Christians believe, and a major reason why, quote, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, unquote, Hosea 4:6. And here we go. I'll turn it over to you. So, hold on. There's these maps. Okay. All right. Well, you want to pick it up from here? It shows a photograph of Bibi Netanyahu. Now, this is where, interestingly, Netanyahu claims the Tigris and Euphrates River in the east and the Nile River on the west as being the territory supposedly granted to the Jews. No, it was populated by the Israelites in the days that Jesus walked the earth, the various 12 tribes, of which the Jews are not a single representative. So, but as I said earlier, the Jews have not proceeded to get any portion of this land for themselves except Palestine. They have failed to garner any more land in the Middle East, going west or east or north or south. Yahweh has not permitted them to get any more land than Palestine, period. Over to you, Michael.
Yeah, and I didn't find the article where you were reading. Do you want me to start to reading Facts Are Facts, the book? Or because
okay. Let me send it to you on Skype because I did put it in the chat room. But let me give it to you on Skype. Yeah, okay. Okay, and I'll continue reading from the inset here. This is the inset about Netanyahu and his claim that the Jews belong in this territory. It's about a page down, actually, where here's Netanyahu pointing at the promised land, okay? But you can see that only Palestine is any part of this area that the Jews occupy. So it includes from the Tigris and Euphrates, or actually it just says the Euphrates, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Arabia, and Egypt. Okay. And other countries, Lebanon also. And the Jews have not secured any of that land except Palestine. And they're not going to. Those are the two blue bands in the Israeli flag depicting those two rivers. So Yahweh is not going to permit them to take any more territory than what. But now, interestingly, Michael, the Jews can say that Judea was their ancient homeland because the Edomites did live there for over 150 years before being thrown out by the Romans. Okay. So they could say that Judea was their ancient homeland, but nothing else in the old world except Judea. Over to you.
I got the article.
Graphic here?
Yeah, okay. I see.
Eretz Israel. Yeah, that's what they call Eretz Israel. Okay?
So, though the above illustrations may have been photoshopped, it actually depicts a major fact of the Zionist endgame. The plan is to expand the Israeli state and make it the center of world government and economics, i.e. the crown jewel of the Jew world order. Yeah, that's what it is. Not a new one. It is Jew world order.
There you go.
The American military Golan is roughly harnessed toward this goal. This is evidence of the immense power Zionist Jews wield over the Jewish government. They do this with mass media propaganda, bribery, smear campaigns against any high-profile individual who suggests with them, and assassinations. Mm-hmm. Most Christians don't have a problem with these Zionist military campaigns because they believe they Jews are God's chosen people, and the return of Jews to Israel is prophetic. However, it is only fulfillment of prophecy regarding the ascendancy of Edom, of the Edomite descendants of yes. Esau, in the end times. When Jesus returns, Edom's satanic, usurious, socialistic, communist system will be destroyed, and the millennial reign of Jesus will begin, with descendants of Jacob Israel as priests and kings. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. Obadiah 1, verses 10.
Amen. Okay. So the Jews have yet to conquer over 90%, actually more than 90% of Eretz Israel. It's been 75 years, and they're no closer. Please continue.
So, dedication to all men of goodwill, of all racial origins, and of all religious faith. Knowledge is a collection of facts. Wisdom is the use of knowledge. Without facts, there is no knowledge. Without knowledge, there is no wisdom. Facts prevent what nothing can cure. Facts are man's best defense mechanism. Without them, men fumble, falter, and fail. Without them, nations decline and fall. Wisdom wins wars before they start. Knowledge aborts national hostilities. Wisdom obviates racial antipathies. Knowledge effaces religious animosities. Emancipation from bigotry preface peace. Intolerance take all and give nothing. Peace rewarded reciprocal respect and regard to all men of goodwill. Pax vobiscum. Benjamin H. Friedman. And so, now the book start. The Truth About Khazars. 960 Park Avenue, New York City, October 10th, 1954. Special delivery, Dr. David Goldstein, LLD. Astor Post Office Station, Boston, Massachusetts. My dear Dr. Goldstein, your very outstanding achievement as a convert to Catholicism impressed me as without a comparable parallel in modern history. Your devotion to the doctrine and the dogmas of the Roman Catholic Church defy any attempt at description by me only with words. Words fail me for that.
As a why would a Jew convert to Catholicism? Probably the only reason is by pretending to be a Catholic, he can promote the lie that Judaism preceded Christianity.
Yeah. Because, and Catholicism is. And it's satanic, the Catholic Church. Right. That is, and financed by Jews. I mean, the Rothschilds are their bankers since the mid 1800s. I mean.
Yeah. The Roman Catholic Church was founded on a compromise between paganism and the papacy, but none of which are Israel. All right, back to you.
As a vigorous protagonist, preserving so persistently in propagating the principles of the Roman Catholic Church, its purposes, its policies, its programs, your dauntless determination is the inspiration for countless others who courageously seek to follow in your footsteps. In view of this
I wonder
fact,
if he's
yeah sorry
I wonder if Freeman's being facetious. I wonder if Freeman is being facetious here, okay? because he's obviously pretending to be Catholic in order to promote this nonsense that Christianity warps out of Judaism. Back to you.
In view of this fact, it requires great courage for me to write to you as I am about to do. So I pray you receive this communication from me. You will try to keep in mind Galatians 4:16. Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? I hope you will so favor me. It is truly a source of great pleasure and genuine gratifications to greet you at long last, although of necessity, by correspondence. It is quite a disappointment for me to make your acquaintance in this manner. It would now afford me a far greater pleasures and a great privilege also, if instead I could greet you on this occasion in person. Our very good mutual friend has for long been planning a meeting with you in person for me. I still wish to do that. I look forward with pleasant anticipations to doing this in the not so distant future at a time agreeable with you. You will discover in the contents of this long letter valid evidence for the urgency on my part to communicate with you without further delay. You will further discover this urgency reflected in the present gravity of the crisis which now jeopardizes an uninterrupted continuance of the Christian faith in its long struggle as the world's most effective spiritual and social force in the divine mission of promoting the welfare of all mankind without regard for their diversified races, religions, and nationalities.
Well, okay. Now, I wonder how many Jews would agree with that statement.
Not so many.
Christian faith, not too many. Maybe two or three. All right. Back to
and
you.
The one that agree are not, they are not genuine. They don't think that in their mind.
No. They're fake. Okay.
They're fake. Your most recent article coming to my attention appearing in the September issue of the APG Bulletin, the official publication of the organization called themselves the Archconfraternity of Prayers for Peace and Goodwill to Israel.
The Jews always proclaim peace. They're proclaiming peace constantly while they're dropping bombs on your head.
Yes, but this will be no peace with them.
Yeah. In fact, the bombs have the word peace written on them.
Yeah,
that's Jewish peace.
Yeah, that's Jewish peace. That's Jewish, what is it, Jewish lightning. I don't know.
Yeah. There you go. No, that's the insurance policy they collect after blowing up your house.
Yeah, or your bridge.
Yeah, there you go. Or ship.
Or ship, whatever they find. The headline of your article, News and Views of Jews, and the purpose of the organization stated in the masthead of the publication, the promote interest in the apostolate to Israel, prompts me to take further time by this forelock and promptly offer my comments. I beg your indulgence accordingly.
Hold on. He's simply Goldstein is saying he's interested in promoting Judaism to the Catholic Church. That's his real intention. Back to you.
Yeah, what would you expect?
Yeah.
It is with reluctance that I place my comments in letter from. I hesitate to do so, but I find it the only expedient thing to do under the circumstances. I beg to submit them to you now, without reservations of any nature, for your imminent and earnest consideration. It is my very sincere wish that you accept them in the friendly spirit in which they are submitted. It is also my hope that you will give your considerations to them and favor me with your early reply in the same friendly spirit, for which I thank you in advance. In the best interest of that worthy objective to which you are continuing to dedicate the years ahead, as you have too diligently done for many past decades, I most respectfully and sincerely urge you to analyze and to study carefully the data submitted to you here. I see it also that you then take whatever steps you consider appropriate, the necessary as a result of your conclusion. In the invincible and intangible ideological war being waged in defense of the great Christian heritage against its dedicated enemies, your positive attitude is vital to victory. Your passive attitude will make a negative contribution to the total effect.
Well, actually, I think we know the Jews better than Benjamin Friedman does. I think he's just being, he's trying to engage Goldstein and hoping that what he's saying about him is true, that he's sincere and not a traitor, not an instigator, or somebody trying to agitate, not an agitator. Okay, yeah, back to you.
Yeah, but Goldstein probably is an infiltrator.
Oh, for sure. No doubt.
You assuredly subscribe fully to that sound and sensible sentiment that it is better to light one candle than to sit in darkness. My solidarity attempt to date, to give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow, may prove no more successful with you now than they have in so many other instances where I have failed during the past 30 years. In your
now he's being more realistic. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Now he's being more realistic. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. In your case, I feel rather optimistic at the moment. Although,
at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although not completely in vain, I still live in the hope that one day on these candles will burst in flame like a long smoldering spark and start a conflagration that will sweep across the nation like a prairie fire and illuminate vast new horizons for the first time. That unyielding hope is the sources of the courage which aid me in my struggle against the great odds to which I am subject for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It has been correctly contended for thousands of years that in the end, truth will always prevail. We all realize that truth in action can prove itself a dynamic power of unlimited force. But Allah's truth has no self-starter. Truth cannot get off dead center unless a worthy apostle gives truth a little push to overcome its inertia. Without that start, truth will stand still and will never arrive at its intended destination. Truth has often died a burning for the most logical reason. Your help in the respect will prove of great value.
Okay, I find it interesting. I wonder if Goldstein ever did help Friedman. There's no record that he ever did. Not that I'm aware of, but yeah, back to you.
Or did Friedman get any response on this this letter?
Or even a response. Let me look that up and see if that he did. We'll find out. Yeah, please continue.
On the other hand, truth has many times been completely blacked out by repeating contradictionary and conflicting untruth over and over again, and again, and again. The world's recent history supplies sober testimony of the dangers to civilization inherent in the technique. That form of treason to truth is treachery to mankind. You must be very careful, my dear Dr. Goldstein, not to become unwittingly one of the many accessories before and after the fact who have appeared upon the scene of public affairs in recent years. Whether unwittingly, unwillingly, or unintentionally, many of history's most noted characters have misrepresented the truth to the world, and they have been so believed that it puzzles our generation. As recently as 1492, the world was misrepresented as flat by all the best alleged authorities on the subject. In 1492, Christopher Columbus was able to demonstrate otherwise. There are countless similar instances in the history of the world. Whether these alleged authorities were guilty of ignorance or indifference is here beside the point. It is not important now. They were either totally ignorant of the fact, or they knew the facts but chose to remain silent on the subject for reasons undisclosed by history. A duplication of this situation exists today with respect to the crisis which confronts the Christian faith. It is a vital factor today in the struggle for survival or the eventual surrender of the Christian faith to its enemies. The time in which we are living appear to be the zero hour for the Christian faith.
No doubt about that. 1954, ladies and gentlemen, he knew it was getting ready to happen.
As you have observed, no institution in our modern society can long survive if its structure is not from the start erected upon the foundation of truth. The Christian faith was first erected upon a very solid foundation of truth by its founder. To survive it must remain so. The deteriorations, the disintegration, and finally the destruction of the structure of the Christian faith today will be accelerated in direct ratio to the extent that misrepresentation and distortion of truth became the substitutes of truth. Truth is an absolute quality. Truth can never be relative. There can be no degree to truth. Degree either exists or it does not exist. To be half true is an incredible as to be half honest or to be half loyal. As you have undoubtedly also learned, my dear Dr. Goldstein, in their attempt to do an 1 ounce of good in our direction, many well-intended persons do a ton of harm in another direction. Well, now we all learn that lesson sooner or later in life. Today finds your dedication, your unceasing effort, and your untiring energy to the task of bringing so-called self-styled Jews into the Roman Catholic Church as converts. It must recall that you may many times the day so many years ago when you embraced Catholicism yourself as a convert. More power to you and the best of luck. May your effort be rewarded with great success.
Well, the history of Spain proves that it's not possible. They had the conversos, also called Marranos, crypto-Jews who pretended to have converted to Catholicism, but who infiltrated the church and took it over until they had to be expelled, okay? This is how Jews convert. Back to you.
Yeah. Without you becoming aware of the fact, the method you employ contributes in no small degree to the illusion of the devotion of countless Christians for their Christian faith, for each ounce of so-called good, you accomplish by conversion of so-called or self-styled Jews to the Christian faith. At the same time, you do a ton of harm in another direction by diluting the devotion of countless Christians for their Christian faith. This bold conclusion on my part is asserted by me with a firm and fair conviction that the fact will support my contention. In addition, it is well-known fact that many counterfeit recent conversions reveal that conversion have often proved to be but infiltrations by later traitors with treasonable intentions.
Amen.
The attitude you express today and your continued activity in this work require possible revision in the light of the facts submitted to you in this letter. you present philosophy and theology on this subject seriously merit. Without any delay, reconsideration on your part. What you say or write may greatly influence a boom or bust for the Christian faith in the very near future, far beyond your ability to accurately evaluate sitting in your high white ivory tower.
Okay.
The Christian implicitly believe whatever you write, so do the so-called or self-styled Jews whom you seek to convert. This influence you wield can become a danger. I must call it to your attention.
Yeah, people might believe you. Please continue.
Your reaction to the fact called to your attention in this letter can prove to be one of the most crucial verdicts ever reached bearing upon the security of the Christian faith in recent centuries. In keeping with this great responsibility, I sincerely commend this sentiment to you, hoping that you will earnestly study to contents of this letter from its first word to its very last word. All we know you will are in the foundation positions to know how close this subject is to your heart. By your loyalty to the high ideals you have observed during the many years you have labored so valiantly on behalf of the Christian faith, you have earned the admiration you enjoy. The Christian faith you choose of your own free will in the prime of life is very proud of you in more ways than as a convert. Regardless of what anyone, anywhere, and anytime in this whole wide world may say to the contrary, events of recent years everywhere established beyond any question of a doubt that the Christian faith today stands with one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, figuratively speaking, of course. Only those think otherwise who deliberately shut their eyes to retaliate or who do not choose to see even with their own wide open. I believe you too be too realistic to indulge yourself in the futile folly of fooling yourself.
Okay, I think he knows the score. I don't think he takes this Goldstein seriously. Otherwise, he wouldn't be putting all these caveats into his letter.
Yes, yeah, okay. it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of caveats, so lots of, I don't know, buttering him up for something. I don't know. It's very like trying to get him into, giving a lot of, trying to work on his ego.
Right. Yeah. You're doing such great work, but if you don't know what you're doing, it's going to result in disaster, right? Well, no, it's going to result in disaster either way because it's like the conference of Christians and Jews. It's always to promote Judaism and push Judaism on the Christians. The Christians never have any influence on the Jews. Never. Absolutely never. Okay? That's the reality. All right. Let me pick it up from here. The Christian faith in jeopardy. Now, he's absolutely right that the Christian faith is in jeopardy. And it's odd that the average Judeo-Christian these days cannot see that the Christian faith is in jeopardy, but they don't realize where the source of evil comes from. They simply don't get it. I remember very passionately in the 50s and 60s, my parents were very much anti-communist. There was a gigantic anti-communist movement in America in the 1950s, and it spread into the 1960s, but the Vietnam War, in my opinion, was staged by the Jews to dampen the anti-communist movement and create friction between the Christian parents of America and their children who are going off to college and being turned into communists. Okay? So, and this was done without any of these Christians and anti-communists suspecting a thing. All right. Here we go. It is clear that the Christian faith today stands at the crossroads of its destiny. The divine and sacred mission of the Christian faith is in jeopardy today to a degree never witnessed before in its long history of almost 2,000 years. And it has gotten worse since he wrote these words. The Christian faith needs loyal friends now as never before. There aren't any. Only Christian identity stands in the breach between Judaism and Christianity. I somehow feel that you can always be counted upon as one of its loyal friends. I think he's just being tongue-in-cheek here. You cannot oversimplify the present predicament of the Christian faith. The problem it faces is too self-evident to mistake. It is in a critical situation. When the day arrives that Christians can no longer profess their Christian faith as they profess it today in the free world, the Christian faith will have seen the beginning of its last days. What already applies to 50% of the world's total population can shortly apply equally to 100% of the world's total population. It is highly conceivable, judging from present trends. The malignant character of this malady is just as progressive as cancer. It will surely prove as fatal also unless steps are taken now to reverse its course. What is now being done toward arresting its progress or reversing its trend? Nothing. Nothing is being done, and he's talking in the mid-1950s. My dear Dr. Goldstein, can you recall the name of the philosopher who is quoted as saying that nothing in this world is permanent except change? That philosophy must be applied to the Christian faith also. The $64 question remains whether the change will be for the better or for the worse. The problem is that simple. If the present trend continues for another 37 years in the same direction and at the same rate traveled the past 37 years, the Christian faith, as it is professed today by Christians, will have disappeared from the face of the earth. So 37 years from 1954, so say 1994, I'd say he's correct. What is called Christianity today is not Christianity at all. It's pseudo-Christianity. Or Judeo-Christianity, which is another version of pseudo-Christianity. So, the only real Christianity left is Christian identity. We're the only ones who preach the covenant message, which is the covenants given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now carried forth in the true people of Israel, the Caucasian, Celtic, Anglo-Saxon, Germanic people of the world. Okay, but even among us, Christianity is pretty much dead. Pretty much dead. Okay. So, let's continue. All right. Let's see. 37 years. I lost my place. He said 37 years. There it is. Okay. In what form or by what instrumentality the mission of Jesus Christ will thereupon and thereafter continue to make itself manifest here on the earth is as unpredictable as it is inevitable. Yeah, well, the clash between the synagogue of Satan and the true offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is, it's called the Judgment Day, and it's coming real soon, folks. In the existing crisis, it is neither logical nor realistic to drive Christians out of the Christian fold in relatively large numbers for the dubious advantage of being obtained by bringing a comparatively small number of so-called or self-styled Jews into the Christian fold. And the editor says, this unfortunately has been the fate of the Catholic Church and for the most part, all Protestant denominations. Yes, any attempt to bring Christians and Jews together to increase the number of Christians has been an absolute waste of time. It always works in the opposite direction. It is useless to try to deny the fact that today finds the Christian faith on the defense throughout the world. This realization staggers the imagination of the few Christians who understand the situation. This status of the Christian faith exists in spite of magnificent contributions of the Christian faith to the progress of humanity and civilization for almost 2,000 years. It is not my intention in this letter to expose the conspirators who are dedicating themselves to the destruction of the Christian faith, nor to the nature and extent of the conspiracy itself. And the editor interjects here, because the chief conspirators would be Jews, editor. That exposure would fulfill many volumes. The history of the world for the past several centuries and current events at home and abroad confirm the existence of such a conspiracy. Okay, I've got somebody at my door. Would you take over, Michael?
Yeah. The word wide network of diabolical conspirators implements this plot against the Christian faith, while Christians appear to be sound asleep. The Christian clergy appear to be more ignorant or more indifferent about this conspiracy than other Christians. They seem to bury their heads in the sand of ignorance or indifference, like the legendary ostrich. This ignorance or indifference on the part of the Christian clergy has dealt a blow to the Christian faith already, from which it may never completely recover, if at all. It seems so sad. Christians deserve to be blessed in this crisis with a spiritual Paul River to ride across the nation's warning. Christians that their enemies are moving in on them fast. My dear Dr. Goldstein, will you volunteer to be that Paul River? Of equal importance to pinpointing the enemies who are making war upon the Christian faith from the outside is the necessity to discover the forces at work inside the Christian faith, which make it so vulnerable to its enemies on the outside. Applying yourself to this specific phase of the problem can prove a tremendous value in rendering ineffective the forces responsible for this dangerous state of affairs. The souls of millions of Christians who are totally unknown to you are quite uneasy about the status of the Christian faith today. The minds of countless thousands among the Christian clergy are troubled by the mysterious pressure from above, which prevents them exercising their sound judgment in this situation. If the forces being manipulated against the Christian faith from the inside can be stopped, the Christian faith will be able to stand upon its feet against its enemies as the rock of Gibraltar. Unless this can be done soon, the Christian faith appears destined to crumble and to eventually collapse. An ounce of prevention is far preferable to a pound of cure. You can be sure in this situation, as in all others. With all the respect due to the Christian...
Yeah, clergy. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, well... Okay.
I can continue. With all respect due to the Christian clergy and... In all humility, I have unpleasant duty to perform. I wish to go on record with you here that the Christian clergy are primarily, if not solely, responsible for the internal forces within the Christian faith, inimical to its best interest. This conclusion...
Right. Has he got that right? Go ahead.
This conclusion on my part indicates... the sum total of all the facts in my book, which add up to just that. If you truly desire to be realistic and constructive, you must hew to the line and let the ships fall where they may. That is the only strategy that can save the Christian faith from a fate it does not deserve. You cannot pussyfoot with the truth any longer simply because you find that now the truth hurts someone you know or like.
Okay, well, he's obviously at this point saying Goldstein, you're a fraud, right? And the Judeo-Christian relations between Jews and Christians are fraudulent too. So he's coming down, and he's telling the truth. He's a conspiratologist, folks. Yeah, please continue. We have a few minutes left.
At this late hour, very little time is left in which to mend our fences, if I can tell it that. We are not in a position to waste any of our limited time beating it around the bush. Now will get us exactly nowhere. The courageous alone will endure the present crisis when all the ships are down. Figuratively and possibly literally, there will be live heroes and dead cowards when the dust of this secular combat settles, and not dead heroes and live cowards, as sometimes occur under other circumstances. The Christian faith today remains the only anchor to windward against universal barbarism. The dedication enemies of the Christian faith have sufficiently convicted the world by this time of the savage method they will adopt in their program to erase the Christian faith from the face of the earth.
Okay, he is a dedicated conspiratologist. It's hard to believe that a Jew would argue for Christianity as eloquently as Benjamin Friedman has done. All right.
Beep.